right, good morning, everyone. I was amazed to see all of you remembered, or at least most of you remembered, that service started at 10 a.m. instead of 10:30. Give yourself a round of applause. That was very impressive, you know. So for the rest of the summer, all the way through Labor Day, we will be meeting just at this 10 a.m. Time slot. We won't have our 9 a.m. community hour. Last week, if you were here, raise your hand if you were here last week for annual celebration. All right, good. This isn't like you're going to be in trouble for missing a Sunday. So last week, we had an opportunity to share some of the stories of what God's been doing in our church community. And honestly, guys, there's no way in an hour service we could tell all of the stories that would somehow capture the ways God has been faithful to our church over this past year. There was just no way to do it. But I'm thankful for those that came up and shared. You know, when I was talking with Peyton and Emily about maybe some of the unique features of life in Gen Z and what's going on, God's doing in their generation, I referred to myself as a geriatric millennial, which instantly got me in our staff group chat. I was instantly getting text messages from Dan up in the booth while I was up here. It was a good reminder that I should silence my phone this week because I felt, you know, my phone blowing me up in the staff group chat. What is a geriatric millennial, right? Okay, so it's actually a term, you know, it's a term sociologists actually use to describe if you were born in that kind of liminal space between Gen X and like true millennials, so between 1980 and 1985. So do we have any geriatric millennials in here? All right, DJ. All right, we got a few geriatric millennials in here. So, okay, you call it geriatric millennials because we were in that liminal space where I can remember life before the internet. In fact, I didn't even have a computer, like a real legit computer in my house until college. Yesterday, I was at a record store with my youngest Ryder, and they had a wall with a display rack full of cassette tapes. My youngest Ryder had no idea what a cassette tape was. So I was like, I grabbed this Elvis Presley cassette tape and opened him up and showed him how it worked, right? So I'm of the generation that remembers what it was like to get, I got cassette tapes first before I even got CDs. But I also remember it was my generation, for better or worse, that was responsible for the development of social media. So my generation started it, and the reason why it got started, this kind of happened in my later college years to early adult years. People thought, hey, you know, these people that I go to college with or I went to high school with, it would be great to stay connected with them through the internet. So you had, social media companies spring up, like Facebook and MySpace. Any MySpace users? Is anybody in here ever on MySpace? Okay, like three of you, that's great. The three geriatric millennials that are here. Okay, but you know what was super interesting about those early social media networks is that they really were centered around getting you connected with people that you actually knew in real life. You know, so it was kind of a way of sharing pictures, sharing updates about your life. But that is not really what social media is anymore. In 2018, this little change happened, which this is going to sound like hyperbole, but it really isn't hyperbole. There was a new company that developed in 2018 that made a tweak to the way social media functions that, again, this is not hyperbole, literally changed human behavior and spiritual formation across the planet. In 2018, this little app coming out of China called TikTok was released. Now, at first it kind of just seemed like this was an app geared towards like middle schoolers for them to share, you know, lip-syncing videos and viral dancing moves. I don't know. That, again, not my generation. You know, it seemed pretty harmless, pretty innocuous. You know, I was like, how is this ever going to catch on? And the videos were really, really short, like super short videos. Pretty harmless, right? But here's the thing that TikTok had actually developed, and it really did change everything. Developers at TikTok had created a new algorithm. And this algorithm was completely different than the early days of MySpace and Facebook, where you'd follow friends, you'd share pictures and cat memes and things like that, right? That was the early days of social media. TikTok completely changed social media with their algorithm, because their algorithm, they figured out the end goal of this game is how long can we keep people's eyes on our website, on our app, so that we can continue to feed them advertisements. So the developers came up with this brilliant idea. What if we created an algorithm that was learning all the time what people liked? And then we just kept feeding them more and more of what they liked. What would happen? Well, what would happen is their attention would stay locked in to this platform, and we could continue to give them advertisements. This was brand new, a brand new development. And, you know, from the very first swipe on your For You page, TikTok's algorithm was learning things about you. Didn't really care who your friends were. You weren't using TikTok necessarily for friendship and connection. They were learning things like, how much time did you spend watching that video? Did you watch for the full 30 seconds, or did you swipe away within the first five? It was paying attention for whether or not you liked that video or you followed the content creator who made that video. All of it was teaching them something about you. Whether you were a guy, a girl, a teenager, whether you were in your 30s, it knew. And it would customize your For You feed using the best insights from behavioral science with the express goal of keeping your attention for as long as possible so the app could keep giving you advertisements. That's how they made their money. They knew exactly how our, you know, in scientific terms, our dopaminergic systems work. Your dopamine is, you know, some people call it one of the happy hormones. It's a neurotransmitter. It is a chemical messenger in our brain that teaches our brain. It's kind of like our brain's reward system. So when something's pleasurable and your brain perceives it as pleasurable, you get a dopamine hit. And it signals, this is something I should do again. And they figured out how to tap into that dopaminergic system, give you a dopamine hit after dopamine hit. Here's the thing. So you might go, well, big deal, like when you're making these grandiose claims that it really changed spiritual formation and changed human interaction all over the world. You're like, Paul, I've never even used TikTok before. Yeah, but here's what ended up happening. The other companies started to see TikTok's success, and everybody started copying that algorithm. So even if you've never been on TikTok, that's a breath mint. If you've never been on TikTok before, if you use Instagram, Facebook, if you use the artist formerly known as Twitter, now known as X, even if you just use Google, if you use YouTube, every single company has figured out that's the algorithm to copy. And the thing is, all of these companies have figured out that what most keeps human attention is the stuff that hits us, not in a rational way. It gets us down to the deep, deep core of how humans function. And they figured out there's two ways to keep your attention locked in. Can you do something that threatens someone's survival instincts? Can it light up that center of the brain and make you afraid, maybe make you worried? Or for the sake of, I think most of the kids left, we can talk about the other center of the brain that it attempts to light up as, let's just say, the possibility of reproduction center of the brain. They know how to light up both of those because they know that's what most grabs human attention. Today's algorithms are among the most powerful spiritual formation tools in human history, and that is not hyperbole. They not only show us what we love, but they shape what we love through countless practices and repetitions. I have had so many conversations with people over the last, 7 years now since the algorithm has changed everywhere. I've had so many concerning conversations with people that have gone something like this. Something's changed in my family member. Like, they're not even the same person I used to know. They're like totally different than the way they were a few years ago. Everything from like, they're suddenly showing these really extreme political passions, and on all sides. I've heard from the far left, far right, wherever you're at on the political spectrum. I've heard from so many people like, I don't even recognize my parents anymore. I don't recognize my son or daughter anymore. What has happened to them? It's not just political passions or conspiracy theories. It is people, I've heard this over and over, this friend I know is suddenly just riddled with crippling anxiety. And again, they didn't used to be like that. Again, we are dealing with an age. Something new is happening in the human experience. With probably one of the most powerful spiritual formation tools in our hand every single day. And it's shaping us in ways that we're not always consciously aware of. We become what we behold. This is spiritual formation 101. What you give your attention to shapes your loves. It shapes what you desire. We become what we behold. So Pastor Jay, two Sundays ago, kicked us off in this new sermon series we're going to be spending the summer in together. And this is all about something we could call spiritual formation or spiritual disciplines and practices. So what is spiritual formation? When I say TikTok algorithm is one of the most powerful spiritual formation tools ever created, what do I mean by that? Spiritual formation, that fancy theological term, all that means is spiritual formation is the process by which your desires, your habits, your values, and identity are shaped, consciously or not, into a particular image. Whether we are consciously aware of it or not, we all have an image of who we are trying to become. You know, as that geriatric millennial, a child of the 90s, when I was real young, it was the image of Michael Jordan. And I saw Michael Jordan on the television. I saw his Come Fly With Me ads, the Be Like Mike Gatorade commercials. And I said, I want to be like Mike. Every 90s kid knew that Be Like Mike commercial, right? And he would do these moves. And then you see in the commercials, kids out in the park trying the moves. And I would go out in my driveway and I would try, you know, the Michael Jordan moves in my driveway. That was an image of something that was presented in front of me that said, and it shaped me. And I said, I want to be like Mike. Well, I never grew to 6'6", so it didn't work out that well for me. But that shaped something. You know, I would go and I'd watch my dad. My dad would go play street ball in the Detroit area. And I would go and just watch him even as a young kid. And I would see how much fun it was and how successful he was. And I would look at my dad and I go, I want to be like my dad. I had this image in my head. Later in life, it was the impact of teachers on me and worship leaders on me that became the image that I said, I want to pursue that. And it shaped my career choices. I became a teacher. I became a worship leader and worship pastor because deep down in my core, I felt like I want to be like them. We all do this. Whether we're consciously aware of it or not, we all situate our lives in a story about the images that are around us. Those images shape us, and they shape what we pursue with our days. These stories that end up shaping us, these images, they are made up of countless little decisions, little rituals, little practices that make up our sense of identity. Cognitive scientists call this our narrative identity. We all have a narrative identity. So if I were to ask you, you know, who are you? How would you respond to that question? Who are you? Well, you might start with like introducing your name, right? If someone would come to me and say, hey, you know, tell me about yourself. Who are you? Well, my name's Paul. But then you take a crowbar and pry underneath that and you go, well, no. That's the name that you're called. Who are you? And when you start thinking a little more deeply and reflecting and trying to describe who you are, what do? You start to tell a story. Well, who are you? I was, you know, for me, you know, I was born in Metro Detroit, and then I moved to Minnesota when Carrie and I got married. You know, I start telling you a story And in that story are countless little decisions and practices that make up who I am. The unique claim of the Christian story is this, that the ultimate image of who we were made to become is Christ. There's nothing wrong with looking up to your mother or your father as a child, right? Nothing wrong with that at all. Nothing wrong with looking at positive role models, people even in our own church that I look up to that have been more seasoned in the faith than me, right? The Apostle Paul might call that our cloud of witnesses. But our ultimate image of who we were made to become is Christ. 2 Corinthians 3:18. The Apostle Paul writes this to the church at Corinth. And we all, who with unveiled faces contemplate the Lord's glory, are being transformed into his image with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit. Notice again here, the Apostle Paul is arguing something that predates modern behavioral science by millennia. What is the Apostle Paul saying? We become what we behold. So if our ultimate goal, the ultimate goal of the human experience, why God made us, is to become like Christ, and we become what we behold, the goal is to behold the Lord, and to have, in that process of beholding him, our character gets transformed. But you know, we kind of wrestle with some distorted ways of viewing what it looks like to become more like Christ. And the earliest followers of Jesus, it's interesting, the title that was assigned to them, people called them this. The first thing that they were called, and this is actually recorded in Acts chapter 9, is people called them followers of the way, or those belonging to the way. Now, for most of my life, in the Christian context I've inhabited, the gospel was often presented to me as something like, do you intellectually agree with the following list of statements about Jesus? And, you know, if you answered true to this kind of questionnaire of true and false questions about Jesus, and you answered enough true, then you had received Christ and made him your personal Lord and Savior. But this way of thinking is totally foreign to the earliest followers of Jesus. And, you know, maybe our ways of thinking about this are kind of shaped by the context we all live in and the way we are educated. You know, most of my educational experience going through K through 12 and even into college years was, well, this is how we figure out what you know. We give you a Scantron test. You know, we give you a multiple choice, a true and false. Maybe you write an essay on the things that you've learned. But that's not actually anything like what it meant to be a student of a teacher in the first century. So the disciples aren't coming to Jesus so that they can pass a test at the end that looks like true and false questions or multiple choice questions. They're not doing that. To be a disciple of a teacher in the first century was to follow them in their way. Pastor Jay mentioned this a couple Sundays ago. It's much more like an apprenticeship, which if you go into the trades, you know, you're getting this at a much deeper level than, you know, if you kind of just go to a liberal arts college. It was to be an apprentice. So maybe a more helpful comparison is it's a little bit more like Karate Kid going and being discipled by Mr. Miyagi, right? So if you've seen Karate Kid shows up at Mr. Miyagi's house. He doesn't give him a test or a book to read. What does he do? He tells him, go paint the fence. You know, so the Karate Kid is learning how to paint the fence, and he's really upset by why am I spending time? I want to learn karate. Why am I spending time painting the fence? But Mr. Miyagi is actually teaching him through the repetitive habit of going up and down how to, I don't know, I'm not into karate. I don't know if that actually worked or not. But like how to block a punch and block a kick, right? Then he sends him out to do what? To wax his car, right? So Karate Kid is like, what am I doing here? Wax on, wax off. I know another geriatric millennial pop culture reference there, right? So that is what it's much, that's much more what it's like to be a student of Jesus than it is to sit and take a test. It's much more like following Mr. Miyagi. And we do things over and over in the way of Jesus. And I want to encourage us all, and this is one of the reasons why we feel so convicted in this, heading into the summer, kind of a new season of our church, is we realize that, you know, I know some of you might not have any social media, or you might not go on the internet at all. Maybe you're one of those rare kind that do that. But for the rest of us, we are living through a time in which the most powerful algorithms, and increasingly with AI on the horizon, we can absolutely not afford to be a people who just show up on a Sunday morning, have 1 hour of worship as our practice, and then we go home and get discipled and apprenticed by our screens every day. We do 1 hour a week of community worship here. Do you know how many hours a week the average American spends on their phone? 5 hours a day. Okay? 35 hours a week on your phone, 1 hour a week in church. Who's winning that spiritual formation battle? So we got to be serious about re-examining what it means to be followers of Jesus. This has always been the case, but especially so in today's era. Now, I want to remind you, before we talk about today's discipline and practice, that this is not a way of earning God's attention, earning his approval. This is not that. This is how we learn how to live in the rhythms of his grace. In Christ, you have already been accepted and approved. We're not working our way up. This is not what spiritual formation is about. We can divide some of these spiritual formation practices, and we were going to go through these together over the next several months, into three categories. This is from Richard Foster, theologian Richard Foster, identified kind of three categories. We have inward practices. So the practices of the inner life, like prayer, fasting, studying the scriptures. We have outward practices, like when we go out and we serve or we give. And we have community practices, like what we're doing this morning, which is worshiping together, when we partake of communion, when we, in the context of community together, we may even confess our sins. So these are the different categories. We're going to focus today on the inward practice of prayer. And I want you to think of prayer like this, especially in today's age of attention farming, where algorithms are constantly trying to farm our attention. We can think of the practice of prayer as attention training. It is attention training to what is most worthy of our attention, which is God. Prayer is the practice of attention training to what is most worthy of our attention. Of course, probably most of us, even from a very young age, even if you didn't grow up in the church, one of the ways you might most think about the practice of prayer is like bringing requests to God about things that might not be going right in your life or someone else's life. And that's a completely valid expression of prayer. So we don't stop doing that. We can call that intercession, when we intercede for someone else. But today I want to focus on a more central function of prayer. That's a completely valid one. I think most of you know already how to pray for someone that isn't feeling well or, you know, that gets brought to your attention. I want to focus on two overlapping emphases of prayer that are more core to the practice of prayer. We can call them contemplation and meditation. These are ways in which we practice attention training toward communion with God. And I want to show you one way that even Jesus did this. So, you know, some of these passages we're going to kind of fly through. If you want to follow along, you can open up in Luke chapter 5. We'll zero in on this passage for a moment. But I want to show you that Jesus practiced prayer. He practiced, in particular, the disciplines of contemplation and meditation. So in Luke chapter 5, this is very early on in Jesus' ministry. Miracles are happening. Crowds are gathering around him. Luke 5 tells us this interesting nugget about Jesus' own practice of prayer. Luke 5, 15 through 16. Yet the news about him spread all the more, so that crowds of people came to hear him and to be healed of their sicknesses. But Jesus often withdrew to lonely places and prayed. Now, if Jesus, who was fully human, fully God and fully human, he being fully human, had a fully human dopaminergic system, right? I mean, we affirm these things. We talk about the humanity of Christ, that Christ didn't just shut off all of the things and the systems in our body that we have to deal with all the time ourselves. No, Christ in his humanity experiences the full range of the human experience, including the fully human tendency and temptation. Christ had to endure the temptation towards the unhealthy use of our attention. And so in order to do that, he even practiced, I'm going to go off regularly and get tuned in to the will of my Father in heaven. I give my attention to that which is most worthy of my attention. When we do that, we reorder our attention, reorder our desires. So I've mentioned this already. You know, you can kind of look at this core practice of attentional training in prayer in two different ways. We can call them contemplation or meditation. Sometimes I find it to be a little more helpful to compare it to a telescope and a microscope. So contemplation is like a telescope in prayer. A telescope prayer that's lifts our attention upward to see a much bigger picture. God, lift my eyes to the highest of heights. Open up my perspective to see what's way bigger than me. Help me see the big picture of what you're doing in the world. Help me see more of who you are. I don't have a telescope, but I live far enough north to when we have clear skies at night, we get beautiful views of the stars at night. And sometimes I'd like just to step out on my front porch or step out on our back deck and just look up. That's like a telescopic prayer. We take our attention and we look up and we go, God, I realize my focus is often like this. It is really narrow, really selfish, really preoccupied with my own survival at all costs. I need to have my attention expanded. But that's not the only way that our attention can get realigned to what is of most concern in God. We can also look at prayer as being a microscope, right? So we can go like this, God, open up my eyes to the big, big picture. I'm not seeing it all. But we can also do a kind of microscopic prayer, which is, God, let me see how you're working in the smallest of details that I often overlook. There's an entire microscopic world that is happening right under our noses every single day, and we don't see it. So God, open up my eyes to see. Make me more aware of your nearness to me. In my boring commute to work, in my washing of the dishes, and doing expense reports at work, Christians have called that practice of attentional downscaling meditation. In a few weeks, Pastor Jay is going to spend more time on that. But listen here to what the psalmist prayed in Psalm 24. One thing I ask from the Lord, this only do I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze on the beauty of the Lord and to seek him in his temple. You know, if I don't rightly see what is most worthy of my attention and have my attention tuned rightly, I will mismanage my attention. And I will mismanage it and give it to things that don't lead to life in the fullest. So the prayer of our heart should be, one thing I desire. Help me to desire you above all else, and then I can reorder my attention from there. I want to give you some examples of practices of prayer. So this sermon series is a very practical, hence the practices, should have a range of practical applications that you can try. We can't offer you a complete range in every category that we're going to talk about, otherwise we would be doing this sermon series for like 10 years. But I want to give you a few. So let me offer to you a couple of practices that you can try this week. In fact, we're going to even try one this morning together. We're going to make this kind of a laboratory over the next several months to learn practices and to practice them together. Let me give you a couple that could help you retune your attention. Here's a real simple one. Start your day with a telescope prayer. First thing you do when you get up in the morning, I am telling you right now, I do not have this one mastered, but it is something I am working to attend and build new rhythms to all the time. If the first thing I do when my alarm goes off on my phone is I grab it and do the doom scroll to start my day, I can tell you I know where my attention is going the rest of the day. Oh, did I get likes on this post? What's happening in the news? That's not a great way to start your day. You don't want that way to start your day. Swap it out with this. If you got to use your phone for your alarm, great. Hit the alarm snooze button a few times if you need to. And then here's one thing I would encourage you to do. Start your day with the Lord's Prayer. Start your day with the Lord's Prayer. We do it around here enough where hopefully you would have it memorized. You could start your day with the Lord's Prayer. You could take something like a useful resource, the Book of Common Prayer, that comes from the Anglican tradition. And they have what's called the Daily Office, which breaks up times of prayer into morning, afternoon, and evening. You could do that in the morning. You could actually use your phone for that. There are tons of, you could go on Spotify and you could pull up the Daily Office on Spotify and listen to it, or go on YouTube. You can use this for proper attentional tuning. So start your day with a telescope prayer. End your day with a microscope prayer. Something that gets you looking back on your day, going, God, where were you at work? How were you moving in the ways that maybe I didn't notice, I need to pay more attention to tomorrow? You could do something like a prayer of gratitude at the end of the day, where you just list off to God. You can write this down. You can do it with your kids at night and say, God, here are all the things I'm grateful for. You could practice the daily examine, and that's something we'll teach and we'll practice here in a little bit. Finally, I want to encourage you this, one other practical application before we actually try something here together, a practice and discipline. I want to encourage you that prayer and worship requires oftentimes that we change our body postures. There is biblical basis for this. There is scientific, cognitive, behavioral reasons for this. Changing your body posture changes the way you give your attention. So let me give you a few biblical examples. And I would encourage you, practice these. You don't have to do them all. Just maybe try one. For example, kneeling when you pray at home. So maybe the first thing you do when you get up out of your bed, if you're able to and your body allows you to, is you get up out of bed, you take a knee, and you say the Lord's Prayer right by your bedside. Jesus knelt to pray. Paul, in his farewell to the Ephesians, he knelt down with them and prayed. Changing your body posture just breaks up that attentional framing. When we just sit in default mode, default mode is what we get. So if we're trying to break from maybe especially a cycle of thinking and being attentionally locked into things like, I'm so concerned about this, I'm so worried about this, I'm just moving on to my next thing. One of the most helpful things you can do is just get up out of your chair and change your body posture. It breaks that habit of thinking. Kneeling, another one. This one isn't just for the charismatics and the Pentecostals, y'all. Lift your hands. Lift your hands in prayer. Lift your hands in worship. You can do the carrying the TV if you want. You can do the field goal. It's good. Whatever. Biblical precedent here. I know you might say, well, I'm Scandinavian. I don't do that stuff. Okay? Well, what if you grew up in a culture that didn't read the Bible? Would you just say, well, it's just in my culture not to read the Bible? No. You'd be like, no. Great, a lot of good things about Scandinavian culture. You know what I also see in our Scandinavian culture? When y'all go to Vikings games, we're not standing like this, right? When it's third down, I've been to Vikings games, even with a couple of you here. When that Gjallarhorn blows on third down in U.S. Bank Stadium, right? Everybody does this. Skull, skull, skull. I'm not trying to convict anybody. I'm trying to encourage you here. But when we come into church, we think, I can just connect and commune with God like this. Great is thy faithfulness, O God my Father. It doesn't work like that. What we're actually excited about, what we actually love, our body moves and changes. So when we pray, when we worship, lift your hands. I'm telling you, the charismatics have something here. And you might go, I don't feel like it. You know, one thing you could learn from those that are really, really great athletes, artists, musicians, they do practices when they don't feel like it. Watch the Timberwolves game last night, right? Go Wolves. Anthony Edwards became the best three-point shooter in the league this year. And how did he do it? He shot 500 makes a day in the summertime. I bet there were days Anthony Edwards was like, I don't feel like shooting 500 shots today. I'm a millionaire, right? So even when we don't feel like doing it, we do these things and then our feelings change. They change as a result. Let me just give you one more here. One more. Walking, okay? From the very beginning of the story in the garden, we saw that God came to walk with Adam in the cool of the day. I tell you what, everybody from the desert fathers of antiquity in the Middle Ages, the great monastic, Christian monastics of the past, they all vowed for, boy, if you just want to have a really good time of prayer, go take a walk. You know, it's hard here in Minnesota in January and February to practice this practice, get outside and do a walk, but on a day like today, if you're able to, go take a walk, look around, hear the birds sing, give thanks to God that you can feel your face again, you know, that the sun is shining and hitting you. You know, the 19th century philosopher, Christian philosopher Soren Kierkegaard put it like this. He said, above all, do not lose your desire to walk. Every day, I walk myself into a state of well-being and walk away from every illness. I have walked myself into my best thoughts, and I know of no thought so burdensome that one cannot walk away from it. How many times, I've done this before. I'm like, I'm just in a negative spiral. I'm like, I just need to go take a walk. 20 minutes later into that walk of just getting stuff off my chest to God and being out and moving, I come back in my house and I go, oh, I don't feel as terrible as I did before. So I want to invite you right now, we're going to take the remaining time from our morning here to actually practice something. If what we do right here lands with you, that I would encourage you, this is something you might close your night with and try it for several months. See if you can make it a habit and make it stick. I want to invite you right now as the worship team comes back up. We are going to practice a prayer that's called the Examine Prayer. This is one of those microscopic prayers where we look back. This is typically something you could start by doing. You could do it at the end of your day. It's obviously not the end of our day, but I thought this would be a good time to practice it. So what I want to invite you to do, you can either, some ways you can pray along with me in this guided prayer is I'm going to give you some reflection questions that are just intended to direct your attention to particular things that you can bring to God in prayer. So some ways you can do this right now is you could just sit with your hands open, your hands folded. If you find that your attention might drift, use your bulletin and you can write down, I left a little space in that bulletin, for you to write down your prayer responses during this time. If you felt it helpful to stand, I mean, feel free to stand. But right now, this is the kind of prayer that's maybe best in a posture of sitting, kneeling, writing, and opening our hands. So I want to invite you to step into an awareness of God's presence right now. I'd invite you to, if you feel comfortable with, just even close your eyes, because that might minimize some of the distractions. And I want to start first and foremost by inviting you to become aware right now of God's presence. That He is holding all things together just as the scriptures tell us that in Christ right now, everything, all things are being held together by him, for him, through him. So take a moment to recognize that right now the breath in your lungs is given to you as a gift. God is here. He is here now. And I want to invite you to reflect on where can you sense that God has been with you today already? Where have you seen God's goodness already in the few hours that you've been awake? Now I want to invite you, as you're hopefully more aware of God's nearness and his goodness that's been at work and is present with us right now, I want to invite you to just give to God. You can whisper to yourself, you can write it down. Express the things that you're most grateful for in this present moment. God, I am most grateful for these things. As you do that, I want you to pay special attention to the little things that we often overlook. God, I got up out of bed this morning and was able to get here. I had a roof over my head. When I got hungry, there was food readily available to me. Now I want to invite you to not just reflect on where you're grateful, but even though we've only had a few hours of being awake, I want you to look back on your day so far and what have been the highs and lows. Have there been points of pain already that you can bring to God? Have there been points of joy that you can bring to God in this short time you've been awake already? God, here are the things that I have felt pain in. Here are the things I have felt your goodness in. I bring them both to you. And just list some of those things off and be honest about the points of pain. Now I want to invite you to think about maybe some of the ways in which you have already missed the mark. Has there been a shortcoming already? Has there been something that you said or you did to a loved one that hurt them? Is there a thought that entered your mind already that you know is not good? Bring those things, bring those sins before God and confess them to him. And finally, let's look ahead to the rest of today and into tomorrow. What's one area that as you look ahead, you go, God, I need extra guidance from you as I try to navigate this part of my day. I need your guidance in this area. Name those things, name those areas of your life that as you look ahead to the day, you go, God, I especially need your help in.